Welcome to this episode of At the Eyepiece. I'm your host, John Kramer, and we will be continuing our exclusive coverage from this year's SolarFest 2016. Up next is John O'Neill. He has 2 decades as a licensed ham operator, sparking an interest in radio astronomy, which resulted in his building several radio telescopes. This talk is discussing his sudden ionosphere disturbance receiver. So please welcome John O'Neill.
Okay, how many of you in the room have heard of sudden ionospheric disturbance receivers? Okay, a few. Most of you, yeah, that's great. Sudden ionospheric disturbance receivers. And basically, when the sun rises in the morning and all the solar flux comes down from the sun and strikes the Earth's atmosphere, what we call the D layer. I don't want to use that one. I'll use this. Okay. And a D layer is created, and basically it's a layer of ionization where the ions from the sun are striking our atmosphere, and it forms this layer. And this layer is great for radio propagation. As you can see, you can have a transmitter over here and a receiver over here, but if you can't transmit through the Earth, that guy's never going to be able to hear you. But once the ion layer builds up, you can bounce your signal off of that and transmit around the world. And that's how a lot of ham operators and radio operators and communications people send signals around the world. How many ham operators are in here? 2, 3, 4 of us. Okay, that's great. And, pardon me? Sure, we'll include you. We're a fun group. And of course at night, as soon as the sun sets, the ions quit bombarding our atmosphere and the D layer disappears. I didn't get my presentation finished, so you'll have to bear with me here a little bit. I think this is the chart. So if you have a sudden ionospheric disturbance receiver, it's going to receive a signal, and at night it's all over the place. There's no ionization layer there, so the signals are just going nuts. But then in the morning, when the sun rises, the atmosphere begins to ionize, and as you can see, it's at a pretty low level. And as the sun rises, the ionization increases until noon or shortly thereabouts, and then as the incidence angle lessens, it begins to wear off, and this is what's referred to as the diurnal hump. And that's what we look for. Now to take a step back, if you go back into history, back in the early 1900s, we had submarines out there, and the Navy wanted to communicate with them submarines, and they needed a method of building a transmitter that could reach that submarine no matter where it was in the Earth. It didn't want to depend on bouncing signals off an atmosphere layer that isn't there all the time. So they built these huge, low, long-frequency transmitters that could transmit through Earth, and they could transmit anywhere. And in 1970-something, the early 1970s, a guy that belonged to the same astronomy club that me and Dorothy and Randy and Pam belonged to, right up in northern Ohio, he was a longtime member of the AAVSO, the American Association of Variable Star Observers, and he was heavy into the photonics unit and ran the photonics unit for over a decade. And when he felt that he had reached his level of expertise and there was nowhere else for him to go in that, he left it and turned it over to some younger people and came to the solar unit, and he invented the very first sudden ionospheric disturbance receiver. And the way it works is it looks at those satellite stations, those transmitting stations. There's one in Cutler, Maine. There's one in Washington State. There's one in North Dakota. There's one in Puerto Rico. And there's one in Hawaii. And they all operate on a frequency of around 21 kilohertz. And he built this little unit right here. And it was called a gyrator because it just took a little radio receiver input and ran. recorder, and it would register a voltage. So all things being equal, if I am right here in this spot, and I pick up that transmitter, that transmitter should always transmit at the same voltage for my location, unless it's acted upon by something. So when you see that diurnal hump, that means that this antenna is recording that signal as it bounces off of that leg. If the sun spits out a CME and all of a sudden the ionization in the atmosphere goes nuts, I mean, you'll just see a straight, and I wish I had a graph here, but you would see something like this, straight up, or this, pretty much straight up and then tapering off. And that's the signature of an SID. Straight up, I mean, it's like when the sun sends out a CME, it all comes pretty much in a big ball. It takes 8 minutes for it to get here, and bam, it hits our ionosphere, and it just goes nuts and sends a huge spike up on this thing. But then it has to gradually dissipate. You know, as that stuff follows the magnetic line, it starts to weaken, and it'll return back to normal. The original unit was analog. And the way they did it is they would have to sit in front of this thing and watch its needle all day. Well, that didn't work too well, but there was another electronics guy in our club who was pretty good, and he built an analog to digital converter where he could take this analog DC signal, convert it into a digital signal, and pump it into a sound card in your computer. And then your sound card would monitor that DC voltage and give you the same thing as what you see there. And that's what that was made with the digital version. Can you guys all see this needle? Now you see, as I move the antenna away, the needle drops. When I move it back, it raises. And like I said, it should always stay at the same signal strength unless there's a SID. And that's how the system originally worked. And still works today, only it's, we don't use a gauge anymore.
Is the left-hand side night?
Yes, all that is night.
Why is that so much higher?
Because there's no ionization layer, so everything's just going nuts. So the signals are just doing whatever they want.
So they're additive signals?
Yes.
That's the signal strength. Because there's no atmosphere, that's the thing that would be blocked by the atmosphere normally.
Mm-hmm. Now today, thanks to the folks, I'm sorry, that's a really bad quality picture, but that is a current SID receiver right there. They are made by the Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers, SARA. And, let me carry on with that for a minute. They're made by Sarah. You can buy this little tin and all the little board and the diodes and the components that go inside it and the pots. And you can assemble it yourself. And you can buy that for under $100. They also give you directions to build the cross, and they send you like 300 yards of bell wire, which is this real fine copper wire. So you assemble your own antenna, you assemble your little kit, you put it in that little can and close it up, and you connect it to the antenna, plug it in, plug a USB into your laptop, and you're recording SID information on your laptop. You can also go to the Stanford University site and download the software. So you can upload your data. Every 3 minutes, I think it uploads. You upload your data to Stanford University. They correlate and compile all that information coming from amateurs all around the world. And then they distribute it to the astronomical community. So if you're wanting to do something worthwhile as a citizen scientist, get involved with something like this. This is a fun little project to do. You, of course, have to build your own antenna. You can either build a kit or buy one. If you buy it, it's going to cost you closer to $200 because they have to, well, they don't have to pay anybody. They have students come in and build the units, but it, you know, that takes time, and so they charge more money if they assemble the unit for you. I keep forgetting my mouse is broken. It's my whole mouse pad and everything. I have one here. I just keep forgetting to use it, and I go to the one up, and that's the up in the corner. That's the logo for SARA. And if you're interested in this, just Google.
So just to be clear,
yeah,
make sure I'm tracking this, because there are people that have antennas that monitor the radio signals from the sun.
Yes.
That Radio Jove project.
Yes, and that's
something different. This is, if the government were to shut this signal off, this would all be done. In other words, the government just broadcasts this signal.
Yes.
It's a man-made signal. If they turn it off or if it shuts down for anything, whatever,
yeah,
then there's nothing.
And it does shut down sometimes, usually on Wednesday if it happens. Navy will tell all their submarines out there, hey, Wednesday from noon to 1, we're going to be down to a bank. But they stagger to different stations.
And
so if they shut Pucker Main down, they'll tell everybody, Pucker Main's not going to be there. So you guys out there suffering, you use these other stations until we get this one back up.
And then the, not to belabor this, but do you need to be anywhere near one of these transmitting points?
No.
Or no,
mm-hmm.
It's that long.
Yeah, these things are very, very hot, long radio waves. And they're very strong transmitters. I think Cutler Main is like 1,000 volts.
No.
I forget, but they're very high power.
So as it jumps off the ionosphere, does the frequency change?
No.
Still
and but this is just monitoring. We're not monitoring the signal. I mean, if the Navy thought I was monitoring the signal that they're sending their submarines, I'd be. I'll be on my way. That's all we're doing, is monitoring the signal strength of the wave. Yeah.
What's the frequency or the noise field?
21.4 right here, but there are
kilohertz.
Yes, kilohertz, not megahertz. Each station transmits at a different frequency. But they're all right around. 21.4 is the middle, and it's Cutler Main. A couple of them are lower than 21.4, a couple are higher. But this antenna is broadbanded enough to receive them all.
So within that signal, there's some kind of digital encrypted transmission going to these that you're not picking up?
Yeah.
Do you have software for that? Is that anything? That would be really cool.
Yeah, I don't have that. I don't want that.
Yeah, so you can't broadcast to them either. Hey, no. I'm gone. Okay, got it.
Yeah, I probably have some equipment at home I can mess with them, but.
No.
But I'm also an FCC licensed ham, and if they found out.
Just trying to talk to my cousin in the submarine.
One funny thing about the FCC licensed ham radio operators. And if Joe Schmo, if any one of you guys that aren't hands out here went out and did something wrong with the radio, then you could plead ignorance and you could say, well, I didn't know. And that's why I did that. I'm sorry. And they'll slap you on the hand if you go home and don't do it again. They figure I'm an FCC licensed ham. If I do that, I should have known better. So I'm going to prison.
But seriously, if you see a spike on this, can you hop over to any number of websites? See if we've just got it struck with something, right?
Yeah, I mean, this signal's coming in 8 minutes after it leaves the sun.
So you can easily go to whatever, the SDOs, I can confirm that there was, in fact, a scene here.
So what's the main practical use for this?
Well, just making the data available, I guess. You decide, you know, I guess they have new support of this. Beyond what I know, but it's like, it's something that I can do to contribute, you know? And it's a fun thing to do. It was fun building the antenna. I did not build an receiver because my eyes and my hands don't cooperate too well together sometimes when it comes to soldering. Although she's very good at it, so I need soldering on her becomes my age.
You're making me miss me for eat kits.
Yeah. Yeah, as I said, one of the things that I'm particularly proud of was being involved. When I first got into astronomy back in the 1970s, the early 70s, I joined an astronomy club, and Randy was in the club, and there was a bunch of old-timers that were really, really good, guys that are my age now, and they took me under their wing, and they said, look, young fellow, you want to be an amateur astronomer, we'll teach you everything we know. So now that I'm the old geezer, I kind of feel like, well, I got to give back to the community and I got to try to do something to help the younger guys and to help the scientific community and to help everybody. So something like this that can contribute some data, I'm more than willing to do it. But these guys, there were four guys in our club. One of them was named George Diedrich, and he was like the guru of public outreach back in the 70s. When the Ohio Turnpike went in, he knew that from Toledo all the way to Pennsylvania, the entire breadth of Ohio, there were like 8 different astronomy clubs. But we never dealt with each other, because to get from Toledo to Youngstown at the far end of the state at the time took 12, 14 hours. But when the turnpike went in, that time dropped dramatically. So you could cross the entire state in 3 to 4 hours, maybe less. If you live in the center of the state, you could get to the edge in an hour, hour and a half. So this guy said, why don't we start a consortium of clubs along the turnpike? We'll call it the Ohio Turnpike Astronomers Association. And once a year, the group on this side of the state will host a meeting, invite everybody along the turnpike to their club. And the next month, the guy on this end of the state will do the same thing. And he got this organization started.
I missed that one.
Yeah. And matter of fact, President Nixon gave him an award for public outreach. He worked at NASA. What's the NASA station in Cleveland, Randy?
Plum Brook,
yeah. Okay. George Diedrich was one of the guys involved in this project, and Arthur Stokes was the guy that actually invented this unit. And this isn't his unit, but this is his gauge. I inherited it from Al Panzer when he passed away. So I have Arthur Stokes' gauge. I have Al Panzer's unit. Al Panzer was the guy that said, hey, that gauge is nice, but we need to convert this over to digital format so we can put it in a computer and do something with the data and make it useful to the AAVSO. So he invented the the A to D, analog to digital converter. And another member of our group was Mrs. Diane Lucas, and she's most notably known for her work at Stellafane. She was an amateur telescope builder, and she was really good. She built a Maxitov type scope when they first came out that somehow the light bounced around inside this thing and came out almost like a Springfield mount, where you could just stand here at the eyepiece and move the scope all around you and your eye would never have to move. And she won all kinds of awards for that thing. But she built the antenna. So, you know, when I got involved with this, I sort of felt like I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. These were the people that invented this stuff and created this stuff and brought it into the world. And I knew them when I was a young fella. Now I'm an old fella. They're gone, but I can still tell their story. So
Yes.
So, is this a device similar to what they use to detect meteors coming in?
This seems all familiar. Well, meteor scanner users mostly concentrate in the FM. They hang out up where the FM radio is at, AM and FM radio, and they tune the channel to where there's no noise. But it gets up to the staff.
Okay, that's my misread. So the meteor comes in, you get a bounce.
Yeah, all of a sudden the radio signal will just take off. You'll be hearing our stations from
absolutely right.
That's
right. Okay. Do you want to talk about the country?
And if any of you ever looked into the itty bitty radio telescope, it's a similar sort of device as this. If you take a dish antenna, and anyone that's ever gotten a dish installation on their home, you know, they put the antenna up and a guy comes out with a signal strength meter and he calibrates that to make sure it's a point and adds a transmitter. If you can take that same signal generator and that same dish antenna and point it at the sun, and it'll read the sun. Because the sun's broadcasting in that same frequency as that radio, as that TV transmitter. The sun's pretty much transmitting everything everywhere all the time. So.
Have you ever seen it? Yes, I do.
Yes, I have one. I'm sorry. It's not the receiver.
Have you actually seen one?
Yes.
Great.
Like I said, this works in real time. You can actually watch the thing and see it as I do occur, and then run outside and look at the eyepiece and see it. Because most of this stuff is line of sight, or the speed of light.
Yeah.
It gets here in 8 minutes. So a lot of times the flare will still be going on during that 8 minutes.
And so will each flare produce disturbance, or always something? I mean, are all the flares associated with...
Well, matter of fact, let me go back to that chart. I don't know if there's any on the chart, but I can show you. Well, I don't know where it went, but on the charts that I had earlier, you saw the diurnal hump. Like I said, when you send this information to Stanford University, they're monitoring all this live. So as soon as the C1 occurs, they're going to put C1 on the chart. And then you look at your graph and you'll see a little. Or if there's an M or an X, they're going to put a red line on the chart and what magnitude that flare was.
So you have a very early warning system.
Yes. Now, it's not an early warning. It's not an early warning, but it's almost a real time.
Like, what would you give me an idea of what that
lasts? 8 minutes.
Oh,
it takes 8 minutes. We're 8 minutes from the sun, so.
Speed and light.
What size is that? Like a decent flare, is it a lot of charts there?
I've never seen it. Oh, on here? Yeah, I've seen them jump, but, well, I can't say. Not on here, but I don't monitor that. So. But yeah, you can see it right on the charts.
So if this were available on 1859, we would have had 8 minutes to get on.
No. It takes 8 minutes for it to get here, and then the chart sees it. It's here. We don't see it until it gets here. Once the flare gets here, it hits the ion layer and increases.
Well, then it's just the confirmation that you're...
It's like all this air went over and hits, you know. Any more questions? That's all I really have today on this.
Our continent in 1981 saw an expedition was watching the flares, and they were in HMRI mode after the repair. I make noises, they went in, they got the science boat, they had the biggest flare of all time, and President Nixon was on his way to China. And it wiped out communications to Nixon for about three or four hours.
Oh, wow.
Because of the ionization over the Pacific.
So
history.
Yeah. And there is another ham in the room. Dr. Allen is a ham on settlement. And so a lot of hams use this information religiously. We use this to monitor the radio waves and tell, okay, should I get my radio out and try to talk to someone in China or Europe or somewhere in the world tonight? Or I can look at the propagation levels and say, well, look at this, we got radio silence right now. We had a big flare today and nothing's going on. So it's very useful to ham operators and communications people. You
this ionization of the ionosphere, it only happens when you're getting the X-ray radiation. It's real time stuff. It combines shortly after that.
Okay, anything else? Okay, thank you.